Welcome to the Hamiltonian Podcast, where we seek to explore various perspectives from top experts, journalists, practitioners, politicians, and academics on the top foreign policy issues facing America today. I'm Gabe Scheinman, the Executive Director of the Alexander Hamilton Society.
Welcome, everybody. My guest today is Nick Eberstadt. He holds the Henry Wendt Chair in Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute, where he researches and writes extensively on demographics and economic development generally. And we are here today to actually talk about the intersection of those specific things when it comes to the People's Republic of China. And Nick published a piece recently in the Washington Post titled China's Collapsing Birth and Marriage Rates Reflect a People's Deep Pessimism. So, Nick, thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
So some of the headlines, the big headlines recently is that China is no longer the most populous nation in the world, which is something that many knew was going to come at some day, but seems to have come faster than we expected. And in broad strokes, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what is the state of China's demographic situation? Is this a crisis or is this just moving things a little left of the expected curve?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Gabe, because we all knew that China's population trajectory was one for a peaking and then more or less an indefinite decline. The surprise was when it occurred, because even a little while ago, the UN Population Division and the US Census Bureau, I mean, two of the big authorities in the field, thought this might be occurring in the late 2020s or the early 2030s. And in 2023, the Chinese government announced that this had actually happened in 2022, almost a decade earlier than expected. Now, it doesn't seem that COVID deaths were the main reason for this. China's reporting on COVID has been, let us say, less than transparent. But the UN Population Division's own reconstruction suggests that the deaths from COVID were in the hundreds of thousands, maybe many hundreds of thousands, not in the millions and millions in China. Possibly correct, possibly incorrect. The main driver was an unpredicted plunge in births after the end of the so-called one-child policy. The government suspended that coercive antenatal program in 2015, and there was, according to official reports, which are not perfect, but we'll work with them for now, there was an uptick in 2016, and from 2016 to 2022, to go by official numbers, a drop in births by about 50%. Starting well before COVID. To give you just some context for how radical that is for a society at peace during times of ostensible stability, the reconstructions of the birth numbers from the famine after Mao's catastrophic Great Leap Forward imply that there was a drop in births during the famine period of about 40%. So what we saw in just this six-year period was larger proportionately than during the famine shock. This is not something you usually see in times of order and progress in established developing countries. So the question here is, why was there a sudden radical drop in births?
And so your focus in both that piece and what you just said now, as you said, focuses on the drop in births. And then also in the piece, you talk about the drop in marriage rates, in particular, first marriage rates. And in your writing, you talk a little bit about maybe there's something actually underpinning both of those things, which is some sort of sociocultural question. So maybe you could try and explain that part a little bit about if it's not necessarily driven by pure economics, although I'm sure that's part of it, what is actually driving the massive change in behavior by the Chinese population?
Well, one argument or theory would be that the PRC is a little bit late to the super low fertility party that's being thrown in East Asia. Because, as you know, birth levels are extraordinarily low in South Korea, in Taiwan, in Hong Kong. They're very, very low in Japan as well. And as you mentioned, the decline in marriages, the flight from marriage, has been well underway in Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong. You could say that they're just kind of fitting to the norm of the area. The problem, it seems to me, with that argument is that these sorts of changes don't usually happen in a six-year period. They can happen over a generation or over decades, but 6 years is kind of like a crash. So why would there all of a sudden be a crash from 2016 to 2022? There are a lot of economic arguments about what drives birth rates, but I find the most compelling analysis, which is actually by economists, is that the biggest and best predictor is desired family size. Under non-catastrophic circumstances, desired family size reported by women is absolutely the best predictor across countries, across time, for what a society's fertility level is going to look like. Kind of makes sense, right? Because we're not rabbits and we're not robots, right? So this suggests to me, at least, that there's been a radical change in the desired family size in China over this period from 2016 to 2022. And what would account for such a precipitous drop at a time when the economy seems reportedly to be advancing, when national wealth seems to be increasing? I mean, one of the things we see in other countries is that fertility track, at least in relatively affluent countries, is that fertility tracks with optimism versus pessimism, with confidence, those sorts of difficult to measure aspects of faith in the future, let's say. And there are plenty of signs, anecdotal, I admit, in China today, that there's been a big change in national mood, in confidence about family, about the formation of family, about marriage. You see all of this netizen commentary about how it's too expensive to get married now. We don't want to get married. It's too difficult to have a child. I won't judge whether that actually comports with the economic statistics that you and I read, but it certainly seems to track with a big change in perceptions. And it's maybe just a coincidence that all of this has happened at the same time that Xi Jinping's surveillance state is being perfected over people, but maybe it's not a coincidence.
I could ask you a whole number of questions of the impact on this, and you alluded to some of it, on the long-term economic performance of China, on it's going to get older before it gets richer, on questions of debt over long term. But I actually want to focus a little bit on the last thing you said, which is, and cognizant at the same time that not everything revolves around the United States and conscious of that, of course, but the impact of these shifts on the U.S.-China, let's say, strategic competition. What impact do you think the plummeting birth rate and the decline in marriage rate might have over the efficacy, let's say, of the Chinese military, or over the decision by Xi Jinping to engage possibly in military endeavors?
That's a really interesting question. And obviously, any speculations that I have are only that. But I'll tell you what comes to mind when I wonder about this. We know already that the pool of young men, let's say, 18 to 23, from whom the PLA would be drawn, is very largely comprised of only children. Maybe 40% of the 18 to 23-year-old young men in China today are only children. If the selection for PLA reflects that large population pool, it's going to be about a 40% only child force. And this raises real questions about casualty tolerance and casualty aversion that I can ask but not answer. I mean, you and I will recall about 15 years ago in Sichuan, when the terrible earthquake struck and all of the school buildings collapsed and killed those poor children, while the party headquarters, which weren't skimped on, withstood the quake perfectly fine. I remember that there was just an explosion of social anger then. It's the only time in my recollection that the leadership in China went on an apology tour to the population, because ending a lineage in the Confucian tradition is not just a personal tragedy, it's a kind of a metaphysical tragedy. So what would it mean to engage in some sort of operation that entailed a significant number of casualties and a significant number of ending of lineages? I don't know. I mean, my guess is that it'd be very context specific, but it is quite possible, given current trends, that by 2040, the proportion of the population from which PLA would be drawn might not be 40% only children, it might be 50% or more only children. There are ways that one could get around that, of course. You just commandeer recruits from families that have more than one child, but that sounds a little weird to me. Well, who knows? I guess the point that I'm kind of speculating about is this. We know that there are peace-loving societies that are willing to go to war and fight. The United States, UK are two that come to mind. There are other peace-loving societies that are less willing to do so. Germany is one that comes to mind. There are aggressive autocracies that seem to be willing to go to war and fight. I'm thinking of Iran. Question is, which box is the PRC in the future going to fit into? Is it going to be an aggressive autocracy, an ambitious autocracy that is willing to fight? Or is it going to be in a strange box where it's an aggressive autocracy, but it's not willing to fight? I mean, these are questions I cannot answer for you. But if you look at these demographic trends, it makes one wish to speculate a little bit about them.
What is your sense, and I grant that this may only be speculative as well, but what is your sense that Xi Jinping or the Central Committee, you know, CCP leadership is aware of these issues? I mean, obviously, over the course of the years, they've removed some of the anti-natalist policies that existed to not much effect, it seems like. But what's your sense of what impact they think this may have, or whether this may be a constraint, let's say, on some of his larger ambitions?
My impression is, and this is only an impression, from talking to my brother demographer and sister demographer counterparts in the PRC, is that the leadership is surprisingly out of touch when it comes to, you know, big demographic questions. That's not to say that an immense amount of information isn't being analyzed and sent up the channels to the Administrative Council and to the branches of government policymaking. What I mean is something else. I had a conversation almost a generation ago with one of China's leading demographers, and it very quickly kind of wandered into a sort of a rant where the expert was saying that he had no idea what was on the minds of the decision makers with respect to the antinatal policy. Did they really think that if they suspended the policy that peasants would go back to having five or six children? Were they that out of touch? And this was back during the one-child policy. Now, I'm almost certain that the Chinese leadership does not collect or to receive any information about family structure or extended kinship structure, which is in a recent study of my own in co-authorship with Professor Ashton Verdery from Penn State. We show that there's going to be extraordinary pressure on the extended family network in China in the decades immediately ahead. We showed that because we modeled and simulated this. There are no numbers on how many 25-year-old nieces there are in China today. But it's quite possible that some of the things we were just discussing are things that the Chinese leadership has not heard about to be blindsided by. If this is a big blind spot, you get into some very interesting questions about decision-making. Would the Chinese leadership be surprised, have an unpleasant surprise in this area? If they intuit this, would they overreact and caution in the other direction? There's a lot of game theory in here, and an outsider like myself is in no position to tell you how this would actually play out. But these are sorts of questions which might be interesting to consider further.
So let me ask you a two-part question here. So the first is there any good news for China? A lot of what you've written, both in this Washington Post piece, but a lot of your work, it seems to me a slew of bad news. And then the second question is, maybe you can help those of us out there who want to follow this more closely, What are some of the key metrics that you pay attention to? What are the things that people should be looking at in the next, you know, 1 to 3 years? And that might be a good tell about whether the decline is continuing and inevitable and in a spiral, or whether there are, might be some changes in the offing.
Oh, great questions. First, I'm not a demography is destiny boy. I think there are a lot of options that a shrinking and aging country has to maintain and improve its prosperity. I mean, take a look at Germany. Germany is a perfect example that a country can continue to get rich even as it shrinks and as it ages. You just have to do certain things to augment human resources, and you have to have certain policies that will help you unlock the value of those human resources. So, for instance, more and better education, more and better health, probably more intelligent urbanization. Those are three areas in which human potential could be augmented. A better business climate. It's easy for me to say all of those things, but as I say them, you can see exactly where the constraints are going to be for China, right? They've had this crash expansion of higher education, and they've created a lot of junk degrees and a lot of people with university expectations and entitlements without the skills to back them up. With urbanization, we've got the awful hukou system, which has totally distorted migration into China. With business climate, we see that the Xi Jinping configuration doesn't really seem to be that interested in unlocking the value of human beings. They seem to be more interested in perfecting the intricacies of the surveillance state. Those would be the sorts of avenues that I would think a country like China could pursue to enrich its population if the regime were so inclined. In terms of indicators over the next couple of years, we have to bear this in mind. Population studies has got no reliable scientific method of forecasting births. Never has. So we're kind of like looking in the rearview mirror to figure out what's going on. It's certainly possible that birth levels will bounce back from the low that we saw in 2022. If they bounce back significantly, my own interpretation would be that we're seeing a return of a certain amount of confidence, or more a reduction of the extreme pessimism that I've interpreted there. I think we're going to see births drop even further, though, for this reason. Until more or less yesterday, China was a very low fertility country, which had almost universal childbearing. Up until the mid-2010s, almost 95% of women ended up having at least one child. If the fashion of East Asia comes to the mainland, we're going to see 10, 15, 20, 25, 30% of women end up childless at the end of their childbearing careers. That will make for a new and even more complex situation in the future because of the enormous number of older people without children to look after them in the future in an economy and society that has only a rudimentary set of welfare state provisions.
Final question, because I know we're running up against time and this could be the subject of a 4-hour conversation. Artificial intelligence. It's a big topic in the United States every day in the newspaper because of things like ChatGPT, even though it has been around for some time. The assumption is that the Chinese seem to be in many ways more advanced than us, although that's debatable in other places. What is your sense? Do they see this as helpful to their demographic situation, that it could help advance economic productivity? It could help fill gaps that otherwise they would not fill by immigration, which would be what? Or is this a threat? Because if the youth unemployment rate in China is as high as we think it is, then the last thing they're going to want is a lot more angry young single men be put out of jobs. What's your sense?
It's a hugely important question. I'm not sure that I've got a very good answer for you. I can spin you the storyline that AI is going to turn out to be a rescue device and a force multiplier in China. I can also spin you a story that it's going to end up displacing a lot of unskilled labor, including relatively impoverished people in the countryside, and magnifying social crises in China. I think I can also make you an argument that it could do both at the same time. There's an awful lot that we don't yet know about how the application of AI will work out in our economy and other economies or in the PRC. So I'm afraid I just have to say, stay tuned.
We'll figure out another time. Nick Eberstadt, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, you can follow his work at the American Enterprise Institute, as well as some of his books that he's written and in Washington Post and elsewhere. Nick, thank you.
Gabe, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Hamiltonian Podcast. If you enjoyed, please give us a 5-star rating. New episodes are released every other Tuesday, available on every major podcasting platform. To make sure you get notified whenever a new episode is released, be sure to subscribe or visit our website, www.alexanderhamiltonsociety.org.